Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, November 3rd, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm speaking to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. I spoke here last week in Mill Valley. It was a great turnout. The topic was investment strategies for changing times. I talked for about an hour. Then we had a great, very lively Q&A session for another 45 minutes. We're making a videotape and plan to have it up by next Friday, November 11th, so it'll be streaming through the Internet. It's available and free for all Solari Report subscribers, so look for that mid-month. Preceding the event, I also did a two-hour interview with Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA Radio on her show, Guns and Butter. It was called Unpacking Mr. Global. She's running it in two parts. We published the first, and the second will be up next week when she runs it on KPFA Radio. Tonight, a very special treat. We're hanging out with the artist today, which is exciting for me. Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright John Patrick Shanley on his new play, Sleeping Demons. It's the third in a trilogy called Church and State, which included one I think most people know about, Doubt, which Shanley produced and directed, wrote and directed, and it was made into a movie with Meryl Streep. Very, very, very extraordinary film. I spoke with John last week. We recorded it last week, so we're going to play the interview. And then I'm going to be talking about, afterwards, the new movie Margin Call. Sleeping Demons and Margin Call are both extraordinary artistic productions. They take us into the heart of the housing bubble from opposite directions. The first, Sleeping Demons, from the streets of New York, and then Margin Call from the skyscrapers of New York. And it really is, if you remember Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, it really looks into the heart of darkness of what we as human beings did in the housing bubble, whether it's the one predatory lending situation on the streets described in Sleeping Demons, or the packaging and selling of trillions of dollars worth at the top of the financial system. So both stories sort of weave the same issues of good and bad and corruption and redemption at both the micro level and the macro level. And as you watch them, you can go from the very macro level down to the street level and back up. It was wonderful to read those and watch those back to back. My theme tonight is I am the 100%. I've been watching this framing of the 99% versus the 1%, and I just can't relate to it because that's just not my frame. I think it's just another round of divide and conquer. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have Jamie Johnson on, and I'm such a fan of his work. It breaks down that sort of 1%, and you realize the frame is much more human versus inhuman, and those who push the red button, if you know my red button story, and those who don't. And then those who make money from doing something that hurts someone else versus those who make money from helping others. And if we're going to switch out of the central banking warfare model, it means we all have to leave a model where there are tremendous stresses and pressures on us to make money by doing something that harms someone else. And so we need a picture that is inclusive and encourages all of us to make that journey of shifting our household and our businesses and investments to something that's more positive. And we want to attract everybody in it. We need wealthy people, and we need worker bees. We need everybody in the new model. And, in fact, there is a new model that can build fantastic new wealth. You know, my attitude is I want everybody to be part of the 1%. But we're not going to get there unless we're looking to both align humans with the environment and then align various humans with each other, and that's a global process. Money and markets. The negotiations around Greece got so wild with the Greek leadership first firing the military, then proposing to have a referendum, then proposing to cancel it with rumors of the president possibly stepping down, and on it went. There's a great commentary in the Wall Street Journal that pointed out that the financial system is much stronger to handle these kinds of things. Equity markets much higher. The reality is, if you adjust for real inflation, I don't think the equity markets are much higher. Do a comparison, you know, price out the equity markets in gold dollars, and you'll see something very, very different. They also say that banks have much more cash, which is true, more than $1 trillion more than in 2008, 2009, during the roughest period. But in fact, if you look at the demands on government for that cash, what's really happening, as I said last week, the banks are being put in a box. They're raising deposits and then having to invest it in government bonds and thus becoming a channel to channel capital to financing government. So, yeah, they have cash, but that cash is spoken for. We had one great quote from the Prime Minister of Luxembourg. I put it up on the blog. He said, "We all know what has to be done. We don't know. What we don't know is how to get reelected once we've done it." And that's the situation. Politicians are very much in a squeeze. You have people behind the scenes, Mr. Global behind the scenes, using the debt system and their position as creditor to force the reengineering of government through the debt system. The politicians are being squeezed in the middle because they are responsible to the electorate, who really has, in many instances, been kept in the dark. So there's quite an ongoing situation looking for politicians who are prepared to do what Mr. Global wants and sell it to the popular electorate, a very hard job. I'm reminded a little bit, one of my favorite lines from Bill Cosby, I'm a great fan of Bill Cosby, particularly his early work, which at one point I knew by heart, and he describes a medic. He said the life expectancy of a medic from the time he hit the water to the time he almost got to the beach was 7 seconds, and that's really what, it reminds me very much of the job facing many politicians, particularly in Europe and America, where there's an enormous shortfall in what's really going on in the retirement funds behind a generation that's now retiring. There was a part of the market that didn't notice this week because they were very cold. We had 1 million-plus households in the Northeast U.S. get a taste of what those of us who live in rural areas have been managing for years, and that's what it's like to go without utility services for more than a couple days. I got quite a few emails from people who are living in hotels or shivering. The central banks are signaling more easing after a big, big drop on Monday. We have G20 meeting in Europe this week, and they have a lot to chew on as the global economy continues to slow down. The stock market has bounced around this week a lot with a severe drop in the beginning and then coming back up, and expect to see the seesawing in this channel for the rest of the year. I still continue to expect the U.S. indices in the stock markets to end the year flat or up. Probably the most interesting story this week is the blow-up in bankruptcy of MF Global, a very old-line commodities firm and a fairly big firm in that market. John Corzine was the chairman of Goldman Sachs from 1994 to 1999 before being replaced by Hank Paulson in 1999. That means that Corzine was leading Goldman during the period that Robin Rubin was running Treasury. Rubin, a former co-chairman of Goldman Sachs, Corzine was basically leading Goldman during the sort of rape of Russia or a portion of it, and the initial engineering of the strong dollar policy, the suppression of the gold price, and the bubbling of the global mortgage markets, including significant mortgage fraud. You've heard me say many times, enormous amounts of capital was sort of moved out during that period. Well, Corzine was clearly one of the leaders. He left Goldman with a considerable fortune and became a senator from New Jersey and then governor of New Jersey. I once wrote a rant. I got really upset. Corzine, when he was running for senator, had a big speech about why women should vote for him and the Democratic Party on the theory that we lived in a patriarchal society and women needed the Democratic Party to protect them against men who were sexist, essentially. And I went nuts and wrote back and said, the men in my neighborhood are protecting me from the drug dealing that we all have to deal with here, because you and your partners at Goldman Sachs and your political allies were busy bringing it in and getting rich on it. So thank you very much. I don't need your protection. It was quite a rant. But Corzine reminds, I'm not a fan of the model of get rich doing dirty things and then do good with a piece of the winnings once you're there. I think we need a much more integrated model, particularly one where doing dirty is unprofitable. But there is clearly a story here. I'm following it. I don't know what the story is yet. We have rumors and sort of indications that customer accounts may have been used. We have another indication that the bankruptcy court may require a liquidation of 150,000 customer accounts if they can't be transferred. That could really whack the commodities market, so it'd be interesting to see. One of the subplots of this story is the chairman of the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trade Commission, is Gary Gensler, who was a partner at Goldman Sachs, and so at one point Corzine was his boss. Rumors that the MF Global situation is a way to basically take Gensler out at the CFTC. He's trying to rewrite the rules for derivatives and the rules in the commodities markets, and there are folks who would like to stop him, particularly the bullion banks. I do think that there's possibly a very important story here. It looks to me what had happened was Corzine took a major European bond position, and it was a position that could, you know, basically bring down the firm. Rule number one is you never take one position that can bring down the firm. That's sort of the story we're going to talk about in Margin Call, this new wonderful movie. Why he would do it doesn't make sense unless he had significant inside information. By that, I don't mean illegal information, but you'll also see, you'll often see a situation where someone like Corzine is trying to get a firm into a profitable, he comes in, takes over, is trying to put it into a profitable mode, and has the backing of a syndicate and has reason to believe that syndicate. And so this to me, if I had to guess, looks like a hit. I think Corzine was depending on, you know, Mr. Global telling him which way things were going to go, and he got caught off sides. And if anything, it might have been a hit. So I'm going to continue to watch it. A new chart up on the blog, a survey of top money managers, shows the U.S. now has a commanding 47% of the big money managers. That's up from 45% in 2009. The next largest is Germany with 8%. France has fallen back to third place. U.K. in fourth place. The Swiss much further behind. That's a very commanding lead, and it shows, once again, the benefits of controlling a very large landmass, the global reserve currency, and the most advanced weaponry. You don't see a loss in market share despite what happened in 2008 and 2009 and all the fraud we visited on the world. If Obama engineered, one of the reasons Obama engineered the bailouts to sort of take banks out of bad paper globally was to help protect that dominating lead. It's a very important part of the U.S.'s power position. In Washington, the president indicates that he's looking to pull troops from Afghanistan. That's a week or two after indications that the American troops are leaving Iraq, essentially, by the end of the year. I have big questions about what's really up here. Are they instead going to turn things over to corporate contractors? Are they really bringing the troops back? I don't know, but this is an extremely important economic question. The impact on domestic flows of the Army not being here, it's one of the things that really slammed the U.S. economy. The Department of Defense flows of sort of feeding and housing an army around the United States are very, very important to many, many counties. That's a very big part of the economy. So when you move that army abroad, those flows go elsewhere. Bringing it back has a very important impact, so I'm going to continue to watch that. We have reports, and they're up on the blog, that the farm bill is going behind closed doors. This is the potential danger of the secret committee. I continue to watch it, particularly because my concern on the food safety rules and sort of centralization of farming, but also the rules on 401ks and IRAs, which now with the sort of the big committee can be, in theory, could be changed more quickly. The shift to handheld devices from desktop continues with Amazon announcing a lending library for e-books for Kindle owners. This is going to be pretty interesting because the e-book explosion has happened, you know, much bigger and much faster than I think most folks thought possible, me included. Amazon now has more than 50% of their sales in e-books. Even I, who love a physical book and buying lots of e-books, because traveling, it's much easier to do with e-books, and of course it's much cheaper. A lending library would make that even cheaper, so I think this could be a major development worth watching. Occupy Wall Street. It's always healthy for young people to get together and ask questions and discuss. I was part of a wonderful dinner party this weekend in Los Angeles. I flew down just for a quick weekend. And wonderful discussion of what Occupy Wall Street could do. And I'm a big proponent that we need to focus on changing what I call the third rail. If you listen to the Jamie Johnson interview, you heard me discuss the third rail in a transit system. For those of you who live in an urban area with a big subway system, what you'll see is, but you'll also see it on trains, the train runs on two tracks, and there's a little sort of gizmo that flops over onto a third rail, and the third rail is where the power runs. And so that's the real line. And so I am a big proponent that we should focus on things that really re-engineer the third rail. I once wrote an article called The Salieri Solution, where I propose that we assert common law right of offsets on the $4 trillion that's missing, and demand that the contractors and banks who are liable for that money through common right of offset, we get it back. We ultimately don't need to know where it goes. You just need to know who you owe $4 trillion to that you can offset that money against. Another place to focus on would be this, again, the food safety rules. What's happening with small farmers while we speak is very scary. So anything we can do to move our, not just our deposits to the good local banks, but our food purchases to the farmers and protect them from federal enforcement, a good thing to do. I put up a blog post, and, you know, I hardly ever use swear words, but I entitled it 99% Bull, and then I had S**T. It was a website that came up, and it was trying to promote a grassroots movement for constitutional amendments and or constitutional convention, which is about the worst thing that could ever happen. I continue to be very, very worried about the New World Order getting their constitutional changes, through the guise of Occupy Wall Street or any grassroots movement. And so I just caution you against that. What they seem to be doing is what I call swarming. They keep looking for what will resonate. This website looked particularly clever because they were proposing a series of debt jubilees, including student loan debt jubilee, which, of course, I think is a very good idea, but not if the price is constitutional amendment or convention. I said to one person this weekend at the dinner party who said, well, you know, things couldn't possibly get worse. I said, oh, no, you take away the Constitution, things can get much worse. Okay, Ask Catherine. A lot of good questions this week. I had one subscriber write in, what do you think of the hacker group Anonymous? I wrote back, just going to read you quickly my answer. I think this is a professional op, CIA, et cetera, or private intelligence agencies. It was designed out ahead of the V movie being launched. The movie was part of the op. My guess on the videos, heavy entrainment, subliminal programming, they feel too juicy not to have it. As you know, I'm not big on secret societies and cults. My impression is that the hackers who've been most effective stay quiet and invisible. So that's my guess on Hacker Group Anonymous. Two, a great question posted up on the blog. They were referring to my description of both Sleeping Demons and Margin Call, Redemption Inside the Madness of Our Current Situation. Question is, what are the couple of key characteristics or skills we can nurture to prosper as we live in this dichotomy of controlled economy culture versus what we do and be for meaning and expression? Excellent question. I can't underscore enough the importance of keep learning. Do more. Anytime you can add another skill, anytime you can develop another practical skill, skills that either make you more self-sufficient or save you money or make you more useful, just keep learning. And just keep building networks. We can't learn everything. We can't all know how to do everything. So keep building networks of people with practical skills, because the more we can help each other, the more we can have people who we trust, who have different expertises, who can guide us in these different areas, whether it's finance or healthcare or construction or in mechanical issues. I think that's very, very important. The other thing I would stress is just learn to let go, because we're in a time of accelerating change and crazy things happen. I was once approached by a guy who used to be very senior in the covert operations at the CIA. Wasn't quite sure who sort of put me on to him. I'm sure there was an agenda, but I never knew what it was. And he was the person who'd run the technology on the Escobar assassination. And it was a very extraordinary character. But one of the things he said to me was, he said, it's really important to learn to let things wash over you. And what he meant by that is there are times when things look bad or strange, and you simply need to let it go, not get offended. In my case, I always took a hot bath, get a good night's sleep, and start again in the morning. And so you really need to be able to suspend judgment. I mentioned a week or two ago, John Trudell's wonderful description of Pandora's box, where he said after seven evils came out of Pandora's box, out came hope. And the idea was that hope was designed to help us adapt and deal with the seven evils. And he said, in fact, hope is the greatest evil, rather than get our hopes up for some distant scenario in a world that's changing this wildly and fast. What we need to focus on what we have to work with right now, give thanks for that, and go to work with what we have and let it emerge. And it reminds me of a wonderful, one of my favorite quotes from T.D. Jakes, who's a pastor down in Dallas who I very much admire. He says, God does not need what you have lost to bless you. So I think the most important thing to learn how to do in this environment is to really emerge things working with what you have right now, and to let go of judgment in an environment or situations where the double binds and Orwellian nature can seem to be overwhelming. Another great question, somebody wrote in and said, you know, what we need is a traveling intellectual circus. And for those of you who are interested in that idea, I would check out the Chautauqua, which in fact, that's what it was. It was in the 20s. Chautauqua, New York, in fact, continues the Chautauqua tradition but it's stationary. It doesn't go out on the road. At various times, there have been many wonderful people who, in the notion of reinventing ourselves, said, you know what we need is, we need impromptu, we need comedy, we need the old Shakespearean theater, we need lectures, and we need to go from town to town helping each other reinvent our culture and our world. So check out the Chautauqua if you're interested. Finally, we switched to a process of posting questions on the blog, and not that many of you have posted on the blog, so I'm hoping, I love the questions, I want to keep them coming, but what I would really encourage you to go to the blog and check out how to log in and post your questions there. Our hero tonight is artistic director Renee Copeland. Renee is the director of the Tennessee Repertory Theater. You can see their website at tennesseerep.org. Extraordinary, extraordinary organization. And they have something called the Ingram New Works Festival, which helps fund the creation of new works such as Sleeping Demon. One of the reasons that Tennessee is a great state, and one of the reasons I enjoy living in Tennessee, is there are so many artists, and it's a very rich cultural life, including down to the community level. In my county, we have an incredible local art center, which is all volunteer, all the productions put on. Of course, there's an awful lot of music and artistic talent around the churches, and of course, with Nashville, country music is very big. But it was thanks to Renee that our production, our wonderful production assistant, Mike Linton, got to see Sleeping Demons and got to persuade John Patrick Shanley to join us on the Soleri Report. And so I want to just briefly again introduce him. He interviewed with us from New York. He is a unbelievably, this is a man who's written many, many wonderful plays, many, including doing the scripts for many movies, including one of my favorite, Alive, Moonstruck, many. it is extraordinary when you, and I've had the opportunity to read Sleeping Demons, the ability of the artist to go inside the complexity of one defaulted mortgage and one possible foreclosure, and the politics of the household, the politics of the community, and the politics of the government in the local area, and really break down the complexity of all the issues of how we got ourselves into this mess. So we're going to play the interview for you now with John Patrick Shanley.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the Solari Report. You are the first playwright. We normally cover economic topics, and our wonderful production assistant, Michael Linton, had the opportunity to see your play, Sleeping Demon, which is absolutely extraordinary. You were kind enough to make a copy available to me, and I've read it, and it's just, it's remarkable. I mean, it's just really remarkable, and it's part of a series called Church and State, which is started with your, I think, one of your most famous, which is both a play and a movie, Doubt. So maybe if we could begin, you could tell us how you came to write Church and State and the evolution of it.
Absolutely. Well, I guess, you know, I was raised in the Catholic school system as a kid and was educated by the Sisters of Charity, who were an order of nuns who wore these sort of peculiar black bonnets that you didn't see generally when you saw depictions of nuns. And later in life, I thought, just on the most simplistic level, I should do a play sometime about those nuns because nobody's ever seen those outfits, except the few of us who were educated by them. But over time, I realized that it was a great backdrop for some of the larger questions that I have in my life, and the biggest one probably being the fact that I function from a place where I know that I don't know anything, and yet I want to be an effective member of the community. So I want to act with a kind of certainty and assertiveness to be an effective member of life. And at the same time, acknowledge that I cannot truly know anything for certain. So how do I get those two things to work together? Doubt sort of came out of that, together with childhood experiences that I had, where I had teachers who I saw were molesting others, not in the Catholic Church, by the way, these are lay teachers, and yet were not molesting me and were actually great educators of mine. And how could I reconcile those things? Which I think in some level is something that every kid, adolescent, and probably adult goes through, that people are a mixed bag. And parts of them can be quite dark and destructive towards some, even if it's not towards you. And how do you take the good and leave the rest? Or should you? And then in the society around me, I saw that American society, that there was an ongoing conflict, attempt to resolve the distinctions between church and state, where one began, where the other ended, and if they did, and where morality and spirituality fit into public life.
Well, I've spent a lot of my life sort of grappling with corruption, how you stop it, how you clean it up, more on the financial side. And the thing that's, I haven't seen Defiance, which is the second one, but what weaves through Doubt and through the Sleeping Demon is sort of grappling with this corruption, both of systems and people, at a very intimate level, and how murky it gets. You know, and you feel that incredible struggle. I know in Sleeping Demon you really feel it.
Well, there's this character in Sleeping Demon who's a minor political figure in New York. He's the Bronx Borough President. And it's not any real Bronx Borough president, but one in my imagination. And he had the history that when he was a kid, he was half Latino and half Italian, that he was raised by a father who had a little storefront church and was a Pentecostal. and that he admired his father greatly and wanted to become a preacher just like his father had been. But then at a certain point, he saw his mother crying, sitting at the kitchen table, and asked her why, and she said that she'd had to support all of these children and her husband, and that she was fighting diabetes, and that she was exhausted and didn't know if she could continue to go on in the vein that she had. And he, at that moment, chose to help people in this world, with this world, the material world, and decided to become a politician. But that conflict between his mother's influence and his father's influence had remained a real, if dormant, in him until he comes into a conversation with a guy who started a storefront church and isn't paying his rent. And as a result of that, the woman who owns the building, a little two-story building, is going to lose her home. And this brings out the latent rage that this politician has at his father for being irresponsible to the material concerns of this world. And so he sort of enters into a prolonged struggle, ideological struggle, with this preacher over what is moral and correct in this world that we live in, and in whatever way that it overlaps with any other worlds that might exist.
One of the reasons that Mike, someone wanted me to read Sleeping Demon, do you know the expression fraudulent inducement?
I'm not sure that I do.
Okay, it's a legal term. When I, if I'm a bank or a financial institution, and I make you a loan, and I know something about your circumstance or the future that you don't, if I have reason to believe you won't be able to pay it back, and I don't tell you about that, I don't share that information,
yes,
that loan could be deemed to be fraudulently induced, and you may not be liable for all or some of it. And
right.
One of the reasons Mike wanted me to know about you and your work was one of the things I was very concerned about in the 90s is I kept saying the banks are fraudulently inducing these mortgage loans. And,
right.
You know, a lot of these mortgages may not be legal because they're loaning to people when they know, in fact, incomes are going to fall, and the people who are borrowing don't realize. And one of
right.
the things
and even
you
if
do...
The, many of those people did not, you know, even if their incomes didn't fall, they couldn't afford those loans.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of loans given out under
yeah.
under the most blatantly, you know, that the math just didn't work.
And one of the things you get into, the woman who has borrowed the loan, she's got two loans. She's got a mortgage and she's got a set. Well, that's one of the things that impresses me. You get all this in somehow without getting overly complex. But she's got a mortgage and she took a second to finance the, you know, the tenant in the storefront church. And her husband is a CPA who's now sick, and it's interesting
yeah.
because, you know, the problems, a lot of the default problems on the mortgages come not just from falling incomes, but from health problems. And so the husband, Max, we open up with Max meeting with a banker and going through all of these different issues of the morality of sort of how the mortgage game is working, both on the morality of the banks and what they're up to and the morality of the people borrowing and what they're up to. And
yes, well, I mean, it certainly has seemed as if morality didn't enter into it on the bank side of the equation.
Right. And but all the different issues of what in the world is going on here and why are we behaving this way and how did we get into this mess in the first place, you know, sort of come out as a part of the context because, of course, the main story is the individual people and them struggling with consciousness. I just have to read one part because I'm used to plays building up to a powerful point and literally right at the beginning, bam, you had me literally, I was laughing so hard I was crying. I just, want to read this. This is Max when he's meeting with a banker. He says, "This country was built by giants. They died and midgets moved in. Tiny people were walking around inside this republic like a 9-year-old boy wearing his father's suit. When the tiny people got in power, they changed what was taught in school. No great books, no big people. Everybody's tiny now. I couldn't believe it. It was so powerful. I was blown away. And then he says, greatness is real and giants come along. You might be one. The opportunity is there right now.
There you go.
It's very hopeful because it reminds us, you know, we are in a time where we're all being tiny, but we don't have to be.
Well, there does seem to be at this time a worldwide leadership vacuum from time to time, visionaries come along and reorganize society based on an idea that is so powerful that it cannot be denied. And it organizes and unifies societies to go boldly in a single strong direction for a period of time. Certainly the United States of America was such a phenomenon because intellectual brain trust and moral brain trust formed this republic in a way that was deeply impressive to the entire, certainly, Western world. And over time, I would say that at this time, you know, the brain trust, which in that period was put to the purpose of the betterment of all of society, in our time, the best minds have been put to work to how to better themselves and to the detriment of society. And also, in effect, over time, to their own detriment. Because it was basically, you know, short-term profits over long-term viability that was going on in this latest economic crisis. There was no way that the financial model that was being used just prior to the mortgage crisis could hold. So it was, simply a case of do what makes today feel good. Even knowing that you are destroying the near future's possibility of remaining a positively functioning economic model.
So one of the things that happens in Sleeping Demon is the borough president is then squeezed by the top executive at the bank.
Yeah.
And we get him sort of in this conundrum of is he going to do the right thing for the people, or is he going to get squeezed by this bank president? And the issues are not all black and white. It's
right.
Kind of gray. Yeah, and it's very...
Well, as they usually are, you know.
Yeah, it's very painful. You know, you're squirming as you live through it. And I don't quite know how you manage to do that. It's you must... You know, I'm tempted to ask you how you know so well what it's like to get squeezed.
Oh, I think every adult knows how what it's like to get squeezed. But you know, basically, when I write, I'm inviting you into the house that I live in, and by that I mean I have a point of view, and I see the pluses and minuses and moral constraints and hedonistic impulses within myself, and they inform my responses to the things around me. And I basically want you to understand how I see things and how I experience complex questions, because, you know, it can be as simple as buying Apple stock and having to face the fact that some of the factories in China are not honoring quality of life among human beings. And how do you reconcile those things? Do you reconcile those things? Do you buy a tobacco stock? Do you buy an oil stock? And certainly, like with the question of oil, you know, whether or not you should own an oil stock is extremely complicated, because certainly oil is
right.
used to many beneficial purposes. Tobacco,
right.
maybe not so much.
Well, but what I found in America, we're always easy, you know, it's easy to say they did this, it's wrong. To get people
mm-hmm.
to look at how my money is working, You know, whether it's the in Sleeping Demon, it's the pastor who encouraged the money to be borrowed, or the woman who borrowed the money, or the bank who made a loan they shouldn't. You're walking people through, you know, our failure to take responsibility in all the different roles involved at a very intimate level. And in our society, this is the one thing that we don't want to look at. We don't want to look at the intimacy, you know, or our complicity, or how it works, you know, in our money and our lives. You know, we don't want to look at me and see what I can do to deal with me. And
well,
yet,
that,
not only are you doing that, but people love to watch the, you know, these are wonderful, successful plays and movies. So you get people to enjoy doing that.
Sometimes.
That's what got me stumped.
Well, I mean, you know, we are not perfect beings, nor are we supposed to be. There is absolutely no way that you're going to live your life without causing harm to other people on some level, even just by breathing. And you must make peace with that if you are going to enjoy your life. And I think that that is important. I think that you are supposed to enjoy your life. I think you should do your best to do that. And that was certainly one of the precepts of the founding fathers, the pursuit of happiness. But not at the ruthless and excessive expense of others. But there are going to be expenses incurred in others if you are to live and to have a life that is not completely informed by guilt. And I very much believe that you should do that, you should embrace it, and that it's a matter of balancing these things and also your own individual conscience and consciousness. So, you know, the title of the play, Sleeping Demon, refers to something that the preacher says of the borough president. When the borough president says that he has a social conscience, he says, do not wake that sleeping demon. That killed Martin Luther King, it killed Socrates, and it will kill you. It is to live a life totally of conscience. Is in a way a form of severity that I think is not truly embracing of humanity. And so you've got to be careful on that front, too. I do, for instance, occasionally smoke a cigar. I don't own tobacco stocks, but I'm glad that I can get that cigar.
Right. Well, you bring all the characters, I don't want to give away the whole story, but you bring all the characters in to the storefront church. And, you know, here's a group of people who've been in the business of sort of helping each other fail. And they get in the church and they start getting in the business of helping each other face the truth and be redeemed somehow. It's very New York because it's very organic and very human. And it's wonderful. And part of it is this dance between the material world and the spiritual world and how to have integrity and, you know, in both.
Well, you know, when you get, you know, when they get into that church, which is a kind of arbitrary church, you know, it's a storefront church. So it's a mixed use two-story building, and the ground floor, which, you know, was a laundromat before, this guy has taken and put, you know, some folding chairs in there and an electric piano. He said it's a church. And he sort of sets about inventing a religion. As opposed to adhering to some organized religion with a definite set of precepts, he wants to say something in his sermon that he actually currently believes and feels connected to. And what he's really doing is he is finding a community. He is refinding the sort of basic building block of society, which is the local community. And I think that one of the problems that we've been having in our society is that the community has been damaged. And part of that has been just simply all of us in our homes on the internet becoming more and more separated from each other and forgetting the great communal power that is available to us, which in times gone by has very often taken place in churches and in the halls of government. and in the sort of sense of like the Greeks did it, you know, where the whole community or a significant part of the community became involved in the political process to the purpose of the betterment of all the people or a great number of the people. And that there's been an isolating thing that's been going on in this country where government has become increasingly insulated from the individual and individuals become increasingly insulated from each other, so that a feeling of helplessness and cynicism is pervading many, many people's individual experience of life.
It comes in a couple of ways. You get the feeling the preachers from New Orleans and has been traumatized by Katrina and the events around that. But the most beautiful one is amazing. You have the banker having a gingerbread house, and as they're having the conversation, they slowly break the house down and eat it.
Yes.
It's the most amazing kind of metaphor image. It's just, you know, as the lies fly back and forth.
Well, and also remarkable. The gingerbread house was a present for his son, so he's eating his own son's house.
But financially, that's what's going on. You know, that's
absolutely.
It's just remarkable. Yeah, I wanted to mention one of the things I promised Mike I would tell you about is I served as Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration, and I got there And every day I started to get this increased feeling of sort of free-floating anxiety. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And, you know, it kept getting worse and worse and worse. And finally I realized everyone was coming to lobby me to do something that would make their stock go up. But nobody was lobbying me to improve the health of places, because the financial system was kind of organized on an industry basis, and so places weren't traded in the stock market, and so nobody made money from a place being successful. And so I ended up coining a term called the Popsicle Index, and I wanted to describe it to you. The Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So let me say it again. It's the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. It's a guy in England who used to call it room to roam. And part of the sort of shrinking from the giants to the tiny is the room to roam for most children is shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And we've now reached a point where, you know, parents don't want their kids to go anywhere unless they have an adult supervision. But one of the things I used to do for years, I used to say what I came to as Assistant Secretary of Housing is everybody was lobbying me to get the Dow Jones to go up, but nobody was lobbying me to get the Popsicle Index to go up. So how do we rebuild the balance between the Popsicle Index and the Dow? And I did a couple workshops with in communities where I'd ask people what they thought the Popsicle Index was. And the power of the Popsicle Index was not that it was particularly accurate, but that everybody controlled it. In other words, my Popsicle Index is whatever I feel it is. And so what it did was it inspired these wild conversations between kids and their parents and different generations about how they felt about whether they were safe in their place. And what came out was this dichotomy that you talk about between the spiritual and the material, or the energetic and the material. And the people needed a way of expressing that energetic or spiritual need in the context of their community, and it was getting eaten alive, and they felt completely stymied. And that's what is so powerful about what you bring out, is this struggle to rebuild that. Does that make any sense?
Well, it's there. You know, right after 9/11 in New York, the streets filled up with people having a natural communal desire to help. It was put to no purpose. There was no way they could find, for the most part, have this very, very natural and powerful and positive impulse. There was no social mechanism for them to become involved. And it's the thing that people in this country are starving for, because there is an altruistic impulse in people that needs to be satisfied, that needs to be put to work. And there has been a long-term alienation of public services from private impulse. That's been going on.
Is there any chance that that Sleeping Demon would be made into a movie?
I suppose, you know, I always take these things one thing at a time. I'm going to do it at the Atlantic Theater Company in the spring, you know, take it from there. It's a good company, and they do good work. But certainly when I did Doubt at Manhattan Theater Club in a 300-seat house, I at that point had no vision that I was going to then turn it into a film. It just became a phenomenon and, you know, moved to Broadway, and then it sort of became more and more inevitable that it would be a film. And, you know, who knows, maybe that will happen with Sleeping Demon.
When is it going to be, when can we see it?
It'll be at the Atlantic Theater Company in April in New York City.
Okay, in April in New York City.
Yes.
Okay. I have to see this.
Yeah.
And so what's next in terms of your writing?
Oh, I'm writing a movie for Stanley Tucci to direct and be in. Called Where's Chang for Fox Searchlight, and I'm going around the country giving a few speeches on similar topics to the ones that we've just spoken about. I just came from Waco, Texas, where I spoke at Baylor University, and you know, spoke to a very conservative population, which I'm very interested in doing, because, again, I feel there's an alienation between, which is inorganic, between various parts of the United States, and we need to be talking to each other.
It's amazing. If you look at just from a financial standpoint, real change comes not when you change who's the president. Real change comes when we change how we individually do things. And
yet...
To me, we've been stuck, you know, trying to affect change at the macro level, because it's like we're frozen, scared to look at what's going on in our intimate space. And that's why I'm so encouraged at the response you're getting, because that's what you're doing. You know, the artists always have to go first. But you're taking us into our intimate space, and somehow it's not as overwhelming to look at the ridiculousness of what we're personally doing.
Well, I'm glad that you think so. I mean, it's you know, the artist's job is to describe what isn't there and should be. So in a way, you know, I read the newspaper to see what isn't in it, and then write a play to fill that blank page.
Okay, well, John Patrick Schilling, we're very grateful for your taking the time. We're very grateful for this play. And if we can't get to New York in April, will it ever be published?
Oh, sure. And it'll be done other places.
Okay, well, that would be wonderful. That would really be wonderful. I'm also hoping for a movie. It was a pleasure speaking with you. And we wish you Godspeed.
Thank you very much. The same to you.
Okay, that's John Patrick Schilling, a remarkable, remarkable artist and playwright. So let's turn to Let's Go to the Movies. And Sleeping Demons had us in the storefronts and the streets of New York. Margin Call is a remarkable movie, independently made. In fact, made by the production company of one of the young actors, Zachary Quinto. Produced it. It's an independent, took it to Sundance. It's in theaters, but it's available already at the iTunes store. So if you can't find the theater, I recommend going to the iTunes store. Don't know how long it'll take to get it in Netflix, but I'm sure it will be there. I was coming home from above San Francisco last Friday, and I'd gotten so many emails from subscribers saying, you have to see this, you have to see this, that I stopped in Berkeley on Friday night to watch the 9:30 show. It was only playing in three places in the San Francisco area, but it was in Berkeley. It stars Kevin Spacey, Demi Moore, Jeremy Irons, and Zachary Quinto, many others. Remarkable, remarkable, just remarkable script, remarkable acting by Kevin Spacey and Jeremy Irons and everyone. But Spacey and Irons are quite extraordinary. The film takes place over a 24-hour period at a large investment bank. The reviews of it describe it as loosely modeled on Lehman Brothers, but I have some comments on that. But it focuses on a leading investment bank who has helped securitize and build this incredible multi-trillion-dollar mortgage securities market, global market. And it shows them at the beginning of the financial crisis realizing that their pipeline of originations is literally going could take the firm down and tank. And so they sell their inventory in one day. And the film basically takes us through the evening when one of the young traders or one of the young quants who's a researcher discovers the problem, and we go through the following day as, or the night as everybody comes in to the investment bank and makes the senior management makes the decision to sell, and then we follow them as they sell and then go home. And what's interesting is I've been in several situations in an investment bank where that situation could make or break the firm. And one of them was a trading floor situation where I doubt it would have broken the firm, but it could have had very significant consequences. And so I've lived exactly through these kinds of situations, and their ability to capture the feeling of it and the stress and the tension is just amazing. I mean, it is so authentic. Reminds me a little bit of Syriana, George Clooney's wonderful movie that we've done on the Solari Report, and Let's Go to the Movies, and you have this authenticity, which is extraordinary. So the review said it was patterned after Lehman. It feels so much not like Lehman Brothers, the culture. It feels so much like Morgan Stanley that it was, and part of it is it's a midtown big skyscraper, sort of Avenue of America's style. One of the themes that comes out is several of the investment bankers are engineers, and you have some amazing dialogue about what it's like to be paid a lot more to engineer these huge paper floats than to build a bridge or do something real for real people. They bring that out. One of the things that you can also see very much in the background is what happens as the federal credit moves in. You see a bank or an investment bank turn from something that have equity owners who have real power. I kept thinking as I was watching it of Ace Greenberg, who used to run Bear Stearns, and the partners had equity, and they had real power. It was a real power base. To now, it's really a political machine, and you have everything driven by the federal credit and the global, dollar currency games, and this is really a top-down game. And so the big investment bank goes from being something that has its own power base to really a political machinery. And the people running it are no longer people who, and this is a real theme you see come out, they're no longer the people who have human characteristics, who feel connected to the people they work with and understand the human ramification of what they're doing. The people who are rising to the top, Jeremy Irons, who plays the chairman, and there's a number two who is the spitting image of Jamie Dimon. I mean, it's such a hit on Jamie Dimon. It's unbelievable who Jamie is, the current chairman of J.P. Morgan. But these people are professional financial killers who do what they're told and have gone beyond worrying about what the impact in the real world is. And what you see is something I saw happen. And it's happened in Wall Street, but it's also happened in Washington, and that is what you see when you break into the final scene. And I don't want to give the whole plot away because I really do want you to go watch this one. It's that the juice is gone. In other words, I saw it happen. I'll never forget sitting in the U.S. Senate and a senator walking in as I was talking to his chief of staff. It's a very powerful senator, a very powerful positions, and he was holding one of these sort of glasses that you that is on top of a float, and you put it in the swimming pool so you can put your drink and let your swimming your drink float around the swimming pool with you. And he said, "What do you think of this as a present for the fundraiser?" And it kind of looked very sort of tchotchke-esque. And I said to him, "You know, I think people want their senator to be distinguished, and that's not distinguished enough." And he looked at me really, you know, with a sad look on his face, because he was thinking, "Oh, I know they want that, but, you know, if they only knew." And what you realized, you could feel it, is, you know, the power had left the building. These were people who were now told from the outside what they were going to do on any particular issue, and the juice was gone. And that's what you see in the last scene when you're looking at the chairman of the company. You realize, you know, this is now a political machine, and the juice is gone. These are not bottom-up power bases. These are machines that are, and Mr. Global pushes the button from outside. So I really encourage you, take a look at Margin Call. It shows sort of the skyscraper version of what John Patrick Shanley did such a beautiful question or such a beautiful job of sort of laying out for us in Sleeping Demon. And it, of course, leaves us with a question of, you know, the juice is gone, where is the power? And then taking us back to the street level, okay, how do we work through what's really happened and recreate the juice for ourselves, where we are in our home, in our community, and with each other? So that's it for this week. Margin Call, make sure you see it. November 10th coming up, Precious Metals Market Report. We've got the precious metals, the price is moving up. Edwin Vieira is going to join us. He's the top constitutional attorney in the country, author of Pieces of Eight on the precious metals and how it relates to the long constitutions. And then on November 17th, very interesting conversation with Dr. William Tiller, who is a professor emeritus of material science and engineering at Stanford University, has done great work on invisible energies and the impact that human consciousness and intention can have and how that relates to material reality. And then finally, very interesting, I'll fly to Switzerland on the 18th, and I'll be in Switzerland and Austria until I'm back for the Precious Metals Market Report in December. But on December 1st, we have Foster Gamble, producer of the Thrive documentary, which will launch next Friday, November 11th. I'll mention it again on the Solari Report next Thursday night, but encourage you to check that out. It's going to stream from their website, thrivemovement.com. So until we speak next week, we'll be with Franklin Sanders. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.